Yeah. What up? You know what it is. Diversity Hires once again. Shu and Sherm shoot the shit about screenwriting. Shu, what's up?
The new episode. I'm doing well. I'm doing okay. The world is still crazy, but I'm adjusting, you know. How about you? How are you? How's your house? How's your room?
Wait, my house? Or my room, or my household, like my family. What exactly are you talking about?
Look, we spend a lot of time in rooms these days, not just in television writing rooms, but like in your house.
I got a new house. I got a new house because I'm making that screenwriting shmoney. I got a new house. I finally got my own office. I was so excited to have a space that was my own. And now I hate this office. I cannot wait to get out of this office. It is my prison. I'm broadcasting live from my office because, you know, I have a six-year-old son. Mm-hmm. He runs this household. And this is like the only place that I could retreat to because everywhere else is fair game. Right. You're not going to get writing done in the living room with like Paw Patrol on as well. So
no, that's not going to happen. So have you dedicated it? So you've dedicated a space. Pre-COVID, you had this office.
Already, it's built to be an office. It's like it's a third bedroom, but it's really whoever owned this place before us, they designed it to be an office. It is an office.
I see. But you used to be like on work release, where you could use your prison analogy. You used to be on work release. You could leave and go to the writer's room, come back to your office when you needed to.
It was lovely. It was lovely.
Now you're on 23-hour lockdown.
Oh my God. I get 1 hour of rec time and then it's back. But, you know, we used to be in the same, you and I work, we've talked about this before, we work for the same executive producer. And so we used to run into each other all the time. I used to spread out there. Yeah, shout out John Wells. I used to spread out there, find my own little nook to do my writing. I would do some writing there, come home, do some more writing. It was just like a nice variety. It's not that anymore. Which brings me to a question that I want to ask you, Shu. Mm-hmm. How has your writing life been during lockdown, quarantine?
Well, I have to say, it's been a mixture. I have actually liked, I have a little office in my house too. I have two small kids, three and one, and my office is often a playroom, and often even when I try to, you know, close both of the doors, that I'm often interrupted, like that guy in that famous news clip whose kids come in, you know, one kid on the bike and the other kid trailing behind in the walker, and his wife comes in. Like that's a lot of what my office time is. But I've tried to take the time during semi-quarantine to redo the office, although it looks like crap now, and try to make it more of a place where I'm going to work. Because honestly, I don't know when we're going back to a writer's room. And I think it's got to be a comfortable place. And I think more and more people are trying to, I mean, I've gotten Amazon package after Amazon package, as much as I have an issue with their workers' policies, Amazon package after Amazon package that have to do with my office, whether it's a frame, I got a standing desk, I got a new chair, you know.
Wow.
But all this to say that I've just been mainly working on writing and pitching, and those things, making it more comfortable has helped. So making it not feel like a cell has helped.
How's your actual process though? Like, how is the state of the world affecting your process as a writer?
Great question. I would like to know how it's affecting you too.
It's impacted it negatively, and I can fill you in on the details, but that's the headline.
I would say, I think I go through days like most people of feeling really down, man, and really sort of affected by everything that's happening, you know, from the crazy president to the police shootings to the attacks on protesters to whatever you name it. It's to COVID. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I will say that that's been mitigated most days by being able to just focus on this thing that we do, just this page, the blank page, the project, whatever it is, to just close everything out and focus on that. And then also, and this is what I love to talk about, I know we're going to as we go forward in this episode, also trying to figure out what the thing that I'm doing here has to do with the world out there and vice versa. And so how to work that into the work, you know, how to work what's happening in the world into the work. And it's been okay, but you know,
yeah.
Yours has been terrible.
It has not been terrible. You know, terrible, it would be overstating it. It's just been, it's been very difficult. I've always been able to sort of produce pages and every day sit down and do something. And I've just noticed like my productivity is down by like a third, you know? And over the course of writing an episode for television where deadlines come quick, you know, you only have a couple weeks to write an episode, best case scenario. And if every day you're still putting out pages, but it's like a third less productive, by the time you get to the end of those 2 weeks, you're like, wait, why do I still have 18 pages left to write? Like, I should be done with this episode. I have a full 18 pages to write tonight. So it's little stuff like that. I also feel like, you know, it's Groundhog Day, or, you know, to make it more current, it's Palm Springs Day. And every day feels exactly the same. And so it's hard to adhere to deadlines because time is a flat circle and it's meaningless. Mm-hmm. And so like, what is a deadline? Like, when are we going into production? When is this ever going to shoot? Why am I rushing to do anything?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, people still want things when they want them. So
yeah,
that's been really hard for me. I think the other thing is I have, and I'm, this is no bullshit, I've had a great time spending this much time with my son and my wife. Honestly,
yes. It's been great.
But they are here all the time too. And you know, again, 6-year-olds do not adhere to quiet time. You know, and it's also like I'm like a planet with like a lot of gravitational pull in this house. And like, so wherever I am, that's where my son and the dog seem to want to play. Like, no matter where I escape to, they always seem to want to fight right outside where I am. So that's also been difficult. So,
yeah,
but you know, look, we're making it through champagne problems because we're both
champagne.
Exactly.
You
know, shout out to all the people who are struggling.
Yes.
I don't take that for granted. And I feel very blessed that I can get a paycheck and
not
have to worry about that.
Yes, for sure. For sure. And I'll just add on a semi-political note, you know, we need to take care of those people who are not able to work. CARES needs to be extended. We're broadcasting this right as that extra $600 that people are getting in unemployment is about to expire. You know, I know people are in my own family are affected by that, and we need to take care of them. I hope the American government does the right thing.
Yes. And arrest the cowards who killed Breonna Taylor.
Yes.
For real.
For real.
So to bring it back. To bring it back more to, you know, the topics at hand, screenwriting. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about how the racial components of scripts and the racial makeup of the characters you're writing about and the stories you're telling, how does that affect the way that you approach the industry from a business standpoint? Does it affect it? And did it affect you as you were trying to break in? I mean, did you consider whether you were writing a black script, a white script, a script that was sort of general market, could be open casting? Do you think about these things when you're thinking about the commercial prospects of a piece?
Well, I'll take the breaking in part of it, because I think that my general answer to that question has a lot to do with sort of just my thought on all those things as getting older. Because it wasn't until I was 34 until I really... I got my first writing job when I was 34.
Old man Shu.
So I also went to 2 film schools. You know, I went to undergraduate at NYU, spent some time working in documentary and reality shows, and then went to graduate school at Columbia. And during that time, I would say I had a sort of a evolution of how I thought about those things. At first, I thought about, like, listen, I care about all stories. I want to sort of be a voice that can, you know, I can write a white female lead character, no problem. I can, you know, sort of have a universal voice, or I can be a black screenwriter that writes for everybody, which is still true, by the way. But I think I valued that. I had a certain value set that believed that. Then as I got older, and this is prior to me breaking in or whatever, but as I got older, I just started to sort of feel like, I want to write what I don't see. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And ultimately what I don't see a lot of is like people I know. Do you know what I mean? Or people who are in my family, or people grew up around me, you know what I mean? Or people were part of stuff that I was a part of. I didn't see that as much. And so then it became from organic to becoming sort of political, which is there's got to be Black voices. And that's thus almost exclusively what I wish to tell at this point. Mm-hmm. Now I'm beyond breaking in at this point, but so Bless. When it came to breaking in, I didn't really have, the script that really sort of helped me break in was a script that was kind of mixed. I mean, it was a white female lead character with a Black female lead character. They were sort of co-leads, and so and a Black basketball team, but not necessarily a Black story, just a family drama. But yes, I saw the short answer is I went from, I think, considering it and considering that being sort of open and diverse was the way, or open and universal was the way, to like not giving a shit.
Got just you.
Doing what I want to do.
Yeah, you know, I've had that same journey in a way. But I think what happened during that journey for me is that the industry shifted quite a bit. You know, I remember when I first was sending out scripts as a pre-professional writer, this was before Black Panther. This was before the TV show Atlanta. This was before Get Out. And like, the only thing that was really popping off at that time, you know, in a major way, was like Tyler Perry and Shonda Rhimes. And so the industry didn't really have as much diversity within Black stories as it does now. And people sort of went with this old wives' tale, like Black movies don't travel. They don't play internationally. They're not going to be big successes unless the Black community only gets behind it. And so I really was discouraged by sending out a lot of Black scripts early on in my career and feeling like they were not getting a fair shake. The writing was dope. You know, of course, you know what I'm saying? The writing was fire.
The Swote.
G Swote. Greatest screenwriter of all time. But the I felt like the feedback was a little bit skeptical of presenting all Black stories. I tell this story a lot. The first script that I ever sold, I had conceived as a Black script. I outlined it as a Black script. My managers gave their approval and said, go do it as a Black script. And the night before I wrote it, I changed the primary characters to white, just on a whim, just because I wanted to see what it would be like to get a fair shake, where there wasn't people weren't coming in with this preconceived notion that Black scripts are harder to make, harder to sell, harder to, you know, find success as finished movies. And, you know, I think it's pretty telling that that was the first script I sold, and that script really unlocked my career. Since then, I've written, you know, besides Television for Hire, I've written only Black scripts, and I found some success there too. But I really do attribute that to the industry changing more than anything that I've done differently in my writing. I would like to bring somebody else in to talk about this subject.
I think it's a good time.
Yes. We would like to welcome our first guest ever on the podcast, Miss Gina. Gina, can you introduce yourself?
Hi. I'm Gina Atwater. I'm happy to be here.
Yes. We should run down some of her credentials because she is way too humble to say it herself, I can tell. Gina, you're from Georgia, represent.
Yes.
Are you broadcasting live from Fayetteville, Georgia right now?
I totally am. I am quarantining with my family, a house full of us who are hunkered down together. It's pretty great, actually.
Better, you know, it's probably better than LA right now.
I was going a little nuts in LA. I won't lie.
We can definitely get into that. Gina is currently just wrapped up as a writer on HBO's hit show Westworld, which she technically has won an Emmy for. Tell us about that, Gina.
Yeah, I have technically won a technical Emmy for season one. When I was writer's assistant, but myself and one of the producers, we were tasked with the world building aspect of the show, the website, the internal emails, the Easter eggs that the fans could find, and that won an Emmy for, you know, promotional and materials and stuff like that. That is something you can win for. So the group, it's a group win, but I technically have one.
That's nice. So dope. And you have done a gang of stuff that you were telling us about offline that you cannot technically talk about because Gina is really on the low, one of the most sought after young screenwriters right now in the world. And she has tons of huge projects that are like on the brink of breaking through should the world ever come back from this disaster that we're in right now. So to get back to the topic at hand, how do you feel about race playing a component in your breaking in or the types of scripts that you choose to write or the types of projects you choose to work on?
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like I'm constantly not paying attention to the market at all and only wanting to write about what I feel passionate about because the development process is long and arduous and horrible. And if you don't love what you're doing, you're not going to make it through. So I always start with something I love, which does tend to be Black stories and stories that I haven't seen before. But that inevitably, you know, this year being, I hope, a major breakthrough, but prior to this year, that was always a big hindrance. And I just never wanted to adjust. So case in point, you know, my very first short, Crossing, that I came out with, very excited. It was a period piece in the 60s in the South dealing with segregation and based on family history, family stories. I was very excited. I'd had like awards for it and stuff, but I got to LA and I feel like I tell this story a lot, but I'll tell it again. Yeah. I got a very specific feedback, which was, we don't know how to sell this. Like, there's no market for this. There are no comps, which is a horrible, dirty word that I hate, which means we just want you to keep making stuff that already exists because that's an easier sell. We can't do anything original. I also got feedback from a Black producer who was like, you know, I really had hoped we were past these kinds of stories and didn't like, I really don't want to tell these kinds of stories that happened in the 60s. And I'm like, yeah, but no one's telling them. And that's what's wrong with America is we're not actually contending with our racial history, case in point, the year 2020. But came wanting to tell these stories and was told that I couldn't, that they weren't sellable. And I continue to hit that wall, but it's been a lot easier having Westworld under my belt. People are more willing to at least attempt to try to make these stories. I do get hit with comps. I do get hit with what I think is a dirty word, which is passion project. Like, this is your passion project, which only means you came up with this idea yourself and you're not executing an idea that I had. And I just think that's weird and so backwards. Heaven forbid the writer have an original idea. But yeah.
Yeah, what's your underlying IP on that, Gina?
Is it a comic? It's crazy. And I found myself when I was very early in Westworld and still couldn't get pitches through, I would back into IP. Like, I'd have an original idea and then I'd be like, well, what's a book that kind of sort of relates to this that I can just have in the room on the table so that people feel comfortable with this, which is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. There was an article about segregation once. Let's option the article.
Yes. Yeah.
Then it'll be underlying IP. Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, I want to ask, because just related to what you were saying, but because a lot of people that may be watching this are aspiring screenwriters. You talked about having, and we should say, we didn't say, Sherman, that we all went to graduate school at Columbia University.
Shout out. I want to definitely circle back to a conversation about film school and should we do it? Because, and we can finish with that, but that is a hot conversation among young aspiring screenwriters.
Oh, yes. Well, we can go back there anytime. I just wanted to ask about your short film, Crossing, won a lot of awards at like you were mentioning. You made that film at Columbia. So what was the thought? And then you said you moved to LA, but just fill people in, like, what was the thought process behind, like, how are you going to break in? What was your thought? I know you did the J.J. Abrams program, which you might want to talk about. What was your thinking behind using the film to break in?
Yeah, I mean, I love Columbia, shout out, but honestly, they taught us there was only one way to break in, which was like make a really awesome short and win Sundance and then off you go, which we can't all do, obviously. There's one winner per year. So I was actually like, I didn't know what to do. Like, I'm out here with this short. I have, like, no one's buying it. I was like, nobody in my family was in the industry. I was just lost. And then a friend of a friend suggested me for an assistant job at CAA. And I took it because I was like, I just need a job. I just need to be in LA and figure out how to do this. Mm-hmm. I wish someone had warned me about how difficult agency assistant jobs are. They are horrible, horrible jobs, but they are very beneficial and educational jobs. You learn the lingo of town. You learn that, you know, there's a code. Like, people don't tell you the truth to your face. They say something just left of the truth and you have to figure out the subtext. And that helped, and that job helped me figure out what that subtext was and what people are actually saying. And I was only there for 5 months though, because I didn't want to be an agent. I wanted to be a writer and a director and figure that out. And one of the agents there, big shout out to Christy Hallbegger, recommended me to become JJ Abrams' assistant. And so I became JJ's assistant for 2.5 years, learned a lot about selling and marketing, which they didn't teach us at Columbia. You know, it was for better or worse, it's about the work and it's about having a good story, but they didn't teach us how to position that in the room. And I learned that from JJ. And then the whole time was writing my own stuff on the side, giving it to the film and TV department at Bad Robot. Mm. JJ had me directing a couple short docs for the Children's Defense Fund to sort of keep that muscle going. And then Westworld came about and I'd had a sample ready to go. It was actually a feature. So even though this was a TV show, they took a feature as my sample. And I became writer's assistant for season one of Westworld. And then after that, for season two, was promoted to staff writer. So yeah, that was my journey. Basically had to go the assistant route because I honestly didn't know what else to do. I had no clue what to do.
I want to talk a little bit about the assistant route because I want to make a confession to you right now.
Yeah.
When I heard that you were an assistant for JJ Abrams, what I thought was, I thought, oh man, because I'm a huge fan of your movie. I'm a huge fan of you as a person. I don't think I had read your writing, but I just thought Gina is so talented. And I thought, oh, here she's going to be an assistant. And 6 years later, we're going to look up and she's still going to be an assistant, because that's what I see so many people do. They say, mm-hmm. I'm going to use assistant as a stepping stone. And then you look up 5 years later and they're still basically an assistant. How did you navigate that transition? How did you make the jump when so many people seem to get stuck in these jobs that are close to what they want to do, but never quite what they want to do?
Yeah, I was blessed in my boss. And I think if you are going to go the assistant route, you do have to not just take the first thing that comes along. You need to make sure your boss is actively invested in promoting you after a reasonable amount of time. The people I talk to when they're stuck, not all of them, but usually they're stuck for 4 or 5 years and their boss is keeping them there without being honest with them and without saying, hey, I'm actually not a fan of your work or your writing and I have no plans to ever promote you or give mm-hmm. you a job of any kind. Mm-hmm. And they're hanging on waiting for this job to come about that their boss has literally no intention of ever giving them. And a lot of bosses are like that. And you just have to not take that job, as scary as it is at the time, where you think I have to take something. Just don't take that job. You're going to get stuck. Mm-hmm. When I was interviewing for JJ, we talked about nothing having to do with assistant work. Like, he didn't ask me, can you roll calls? Can you keep on charge of my schedule? He said, tell me about the movies you've made. And mm-hmm. that's literally all we talked about. And so I had a good feeling that he saw me as not just his assistant forever and ever and ever and ever, but he saw me as one day I'm going to have to find this girl a job, another job. Can she handle that other job as well? Mm. And I think that's what you should look for in a boss if you're going the assistant route.
Mm.
That's very good.
Great advice.
Yeah.
I got a million questions, Shu, but I don't want
to
hog.
No, keep going. I, there's something I want to go back to, but I think it's off track. So good, go.
Okay. The other question I wanted to ask you, Gina, is you, again, we've talked about your short a lot. I saw your short actually for the first time out here in LA, where I think it had won something. What was that? That screening that I went to.
Did you go to the NBC? Did you go to the NBC? Yeah.
What was that that you won?
That was the NBC Universal Shortcuts Festival, which I don't even know if they do anymore, but that was for filmmakers of color as a showcase. It's funny, like I still have executives. I'll go to either a general or a pitch and they'll be like, "Hey, I remember you from NBC Shortcuts." It's really weird.
Dope. Well, I saw it there and I thought it was so great. And I'm wondering, talk to me about the director track versus the writing track, because you obviously have both skills under your belt. You've won some acclaim for both. How did you get on the screenwriting track so clearly when you had a short film that you directed?
Yeah, I mean, I went to Columbia to write. I had no idea I could direct until they made us learn directing. And then I was like, oh, this is great. So I do still consider myself a writer first and foremost. And honestly, it's just much easier to write over and over and over again than it is to keep directing and having samples. Like, directing costs money, and that's money like I don't have.
Real talk, yes. Real talk.
And writing, it's my final draft. I paid for final draft one time,
that's
and
right.
I avoid upgrading, and that is all I need. And yes, directing, like, I need a camera, I need, like,
Telling.
I need equipment, I need a crew, I need actors,
yes,
I need, like, COVID safety regulations.
You
like,
know?
It's hard. It's much harder. It's
the return, much harder. The return on investment for writing, I think, is much higher yield.
Yes, and there are way more jobs. Way more writing job.
Absolutely.
But if you're out there and you're like, but I'm a director, stick with that. I'm not saying don't stick with it.
Well, you know, it's funny because I'm sort of always envious of directors. I know a few people who I consider peers who were really on their directing grind at the same time that I started off on my writing grind. And those of them who have made like a good feature, even if it was short, I mean, even if it was a low budget feature, even if it was, you know, even if it wasn't a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination, making a good finished product of something is super valuable in this industry. And I've sort of seen them, you know, enter the ladder of success, like horizontally, a few rungs above me. And I've been grinding from the bottom for a long time, but I've seen indie directors get great, like, rewriting jobs just because they were a writer director on a finished product. So I think there is value in putting some effort into actually making something. But like you said, it's expensive. It is a labor of love. In the time that it takes to get an independent movie off the ground, you could write 3 or 4 scripts. One of those scripts could hit for you. So I think you really just got to follow your passion in the end, right?
Yeah. And I think you should, you know, like, it's going to take forever. We're all going to be 70-year-old probably when my first feature comes out, but I still do both lanes, you know? And it's just such a long process, but yeah, I never stopped pursuing directing. It's just that because of the nature of the business, the writing stuff kicked off first.
Got you.
I want to go back to a couple of things. This is a little off topic, but whatever, that's what we're here for. We just talk about stuff in general. You mentioned the comment, which I found that story so fascinating about crossing and what people had said to you, especially the black executive, whoever that was. And then no knock on them, maybe they had some intention, bigger intention behind that comment. But it reminded me, speaking of current stuff, it reminded me of what Robin Thede was talking about, if you guys remember, a few weeks ago, which was this notion of that we need more current black stories, that we need stories about black people living their everyday lives and existing. And she certainly wasn't trying to knock historical stories, but I ended up having the same kind of reaction to that where I thought, well, yes, that is very much true, but it's not as if we see so many of these like black historical stories out there that the market is just so saturated with these historical stories that we're, we really have a lack of that, it, you know what I mean? That it's causing some sort of problem. I wanted to know, you know, because a lot of the stuff that you at least have talked about offline talks about your approach to stories seem to have, if not a historical bent, then certainly like a Southern cultural bent. And I wonder how much does sort of history, racial history, the stories that are passed down factor into your work versus sort of contemporary stories, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I'm drawn to worlds and people and stories that I've never seen before. So, and I'm a history buff, so a lot of time I do mine history. History and fantasy, those are my two genres. So I do tend to gravitate to historical stories, and I do get where Robin's coming from. Hi, Robin, love you. but I think, you know, there is this bias, like from studios and networks, they're like, oh, but we have the one Black story that like took place between 1700 and 1999. So we have our one Black period piece. We don't need any more. And it's frustrating to me because it's like, no one is saying to Martin Scorsese, we don't need any more period gangster movies. Like no one is saying that to him at all. But for some reason, we do one Black story that's not contemporary. And we're like, done. Did it,
yes.
Shouldn't do anything else, shouldn't mind any of their stories. And Black history is vast and varied, and so there's vast. So much stuff. There's so much stuff to mine, and there should be no reason that we're, you know, not allowed to mine it. That's what I
agree.
I want to jump in a little bit to push back just a little bit.
Okay, I'm push back.
The naysayer for 1 second, because what I think happens, I have this theory that Hollywood in general is very uncomfortable with Black stories across the board, historical, civil rights, contemporary, whatever, because they really don't understand Black culture. And they really have, there's no collective in to like understanding how Black people relate to each other, how diverse the Black community actually is, how diverse our experiences across history and across this nation really are. And I think the thing that they have found the most comfort in is a true story that's based on something having to do with the struggle. Because if it's true, nobody can sort of critique it as, it's harder to critique it as having racial missteps or stereotypical missteps, because you can always say it's true. And secondarily, it's a very comfortable and easy story to tell about sort of Black determination and community in the face of the quote unquote struggle. So I actually find that a lot of what I hear from Hollywood executives is trying to push me into that direction, to tell some story that exists as a historical story that has to do, takes place some time in our vast history about the struggle, civil rights, the quest for freedom. I find that I get pushed in that direction more than somebody is sort of against taking on those stories.
I think what's important that you're saying is like there's this narrow lane that's like palatable to executives who are not people of color, and this one slice that they can understand. Whereas like if you have, say you have a historical movie that's like, this is actually about the like gens de couleur in New Orleans, and they're rich and they're going to debutante balls, and everyone's like,
we don't understand that.
I don't get it. I don't understand that.
I literally have no idea what you're talking about. So I want to see that movie.
Exactly.
I feel ignorant right now. Shu was acting like he knew what you were talking about. So I'm.
I don't, but at least I know. At least I know. It hits the point that there are different kinds of historical stories. I think you're right, Sherman, when it comes to that sort of whatever genre that is, Black people overcoming the struggle genre. Mm-hmm. Whatever that is, there is a formula, or there are certain ways in which that can be formulaic, and we've seen it a million times. And I think who's tired of that more than anybody is probably Black people. But I don't think that that's like, I don't think that's a knock on the history films or television series. I think that's a knock on that particular treatment. I think people make fire of that, but
which is why you need to give Gina the money to do what she wants and accept that a dope black artist is going to be able to tell that story in a way that is surprising and new and relevant. And I think about a movie that I really love, Selma. I don't know how everybody else feels about Selma, but I love that movie because it felt like a fresh take on a, you know, a historical figure that we've talked about ad nauseum forever, rightfully so, but it felt like a fresh portrayal. And so I think that I'm not knocking the need for historical stories or mining our history to find great stories. I'm just saying that I think that that is a place where white Hollywood in particular feels very, very comfortable. I would, you know, it's the same thing. I think it's very similar to gay stories, right? Like how many, every gay story you see is the coming out story or the coming to terms with sexuality story. You never see, for example, a gay film noir, right? Like, because Hollywood at some point decided that's the story of this minority group that they're interested in telling. I think that that's happened a lot for our historical and dramas, especially around slavery and the civil rights era. So I do oftentimes feel like I, as you know, in the stuff that I pitch, I feel like I can't just tell a story that is about the story and the narrative and the fun first. I feel like I'm always getting funneled back towards, well, what does this say about the struggle? I'm like, yo,
really?
I'm a black dude. Yes. You don't feel
that's
that?
Interesting.
I don't, but I do get something similar, which is the comps. So like what you're saying is like, there are comps for that kind of story. There's like Harriet Tubman. There's like all the, so I say that to them, like, it's like this meets that. And they go, oh, great. Let's make it. Cause it's the exact same version of black history that I'm used to.
Yeah.
Right.
Wait, I'm surprised you really don't feel funneled into that sort of like having to address social issues in when you present black characters. Who are you meeting with? I would like to meet with them.
I've been told to downplay it actually.
Yeah. Especially if anything. Yeah,
we're having totally different experiences in this industry. Because I would love to hear sort of when I present a black story that is not, all my stories are, when I tell any kind of character, but specifically black people, they're always going to include some of that, right? Because that is a daily reality for us. I can't write stories about black people that are true to life without including some idea about how race affects our day-to-day life. Because when we walk out of our door, it's a reality for us.
Right.
However, I feel like where a lot of white executives feel really comfortable is explicitly addressing those issues as they relate to the historical quest against, you know, tyranny and oppression and our quest for justice and freedom. I feel like I'm always funneled into saying more explicitly discussing those social issues than I actually feel comfortable with. I'm surprised to hear you guys say that you have the opposite. Let's trade for it.
I'll give you an example. I'm working on this quote passion project as about Stokely Carmichael, and we're about to go out, you know, hopefully in the next matter of weeks with this pitch. And I've been developing this pitch for a couple of years now. But one of the things I kept getting from the producers that are involved and even our agents, I kept, because I love history like Gina, I kept hitting the, like, these are the pieces of the freedom struggle that Stokely Carmichael is a part of, from freedom riders to marches to Black Power, et cetera. And I kept getting the note back. Okay, great. But what about like his just coming of age as a young man? What about just like, when does he get drunk for the first time? When does he lose his virginity? When does, you know, just him? Do you know what I mean? And that's been the part of the pitch that I've sort of pumped up more and more and more. So I don't think people like to think critically about history very much. So they'd like to sort of lean into the more like, what's the universal kind of like fun? That's what I get more. Actually, it's the opposite.
Wow. We need to trade for a day. Sounds like you guys are getting the kinds of notes that I would actually like to receive.
The ones to like down, and I even have like the movie I'm supposed to direct. It's contemporary, but mm-hmm. the very first round of people, it's a black girl in the lead, 19. I can't say what the final reveal is, but it has to do with like issues of consent and sexual assault. And mm-hmm. the first round of notes was like, I'm confused. Is she dealing with race or her gender? And it's like, okay, well, when you're a black woman, you deal with both. And they're just like, okay, why don't we like, you know, why don't we like pick gender or something, like just pick gender and maybe like downplay the race stuff, you know? And so I'm with Shakri. Wow. I get the yeah. kind of Shakri.
Yeah.
I need to reevaluate who I'm meeting with.
or we should like meet with your people. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe we're doing it wrong, man.
Yeah. Cause sometimes I just like want to tell like a sci-fi adventure with black people. And I feel yeah. like I'm constantly getting the note of like, well, how is this about race? How is this about the struggle?
Oh, interesting.
And I'm like, well, it's there because I'm presenting black characters who are true to life and dealing with that every day, but it's not the top line headline about what this story actually is. Anyway.
We need to talk about who those people are. Yeah.
I need to reevaluate.
Well, can I bring up a separate subject, Sherm, for Gina? You hit on this too, because, you know, again, people, I'd like to think that people listening to this are a mixture of folks. A lot of folks might be working in the industry now, navigating it like all three of us are. You talked a little bit about development because you're developing a lot of different pieces. Some you can talk about, some you can't. You know, Sherman and I have talked about this before, but where do you fall? And you hit on it a little bit, but where do you fall on like, you know, I'm just going to come up with original ideas and take it to people, and versus the calls and probably a person in your position, maybe even the endless calls or emails that you get about developing this book or developing that book, which you can make your own, you know, but how do you sort of balance both those things and what's your preference and why?
Yeah, I do get a lot of asks to adapt pre-existing IP or an idea that executives are kicking around. And I always do consider them very carefully. I'm not like the kind of person who's like, only my ideas are good. And if I didn't come up with it, I don't want to do it. But having said that, I do have to connect very, very strongly with the piece that I'm getting and have a very clear sense almost right away of what I would do with it, because I have learned that that is the good sign that I can survive the intense and very overlong development process with this piece of material. If I get struck with it almost as if it were my own idea and I know exactly my way in and what I want to say about the world and I get the character and I get the voice and I want to do it. If I'm even remotely on the fence about it, I'll turn it down because that means they don't have what it takes to get through the years of living with the project. So I try to always evaluate when it comes in, and if I like something and it kicks down the road something of my own, then I let it kick that down the road. Because to me, it's all of a piece. It's all gonna filter through me, and it's all going to be like what I want to say to the world, you know, once I'm allowed to say it and I get through all of the rounds of notes that are necessary to get to an actual screen.
Do you think that is it more difficult to get something that's just yours, that you just came up with in your living room and, you know, worked on sort of over the line, than it is something that it's pre-existing?
Oh yeah, it's way more difficult. I don't understand when like writers' original ideas became something to be viewed with skepticism, but they are.
When you tell like, me, please, you know, when you find out, please tell me, because that's crazy.
Yeah,
oh my God.
I don't understand when the writer became like the weirdo who like, we have to keep them from having original ideas because those ideas are weird. It's so much harder for me to sell something that I came up with. And it's just, I really can't say it's anything other than bias. And I don't know where this bias came from, because it's like, I'm sorry, but I didn't decide to become a writer to like transcribe other people's ideas.
What is this?
I became a writer because I wanted to tell original stories. But I do think it's because like this town is risk averse, and usually writer ideas, we tend to gravitate toward things we've never seen before. We tend to gravitate towards things we think people need to see or hear or contend with, characters they've not had in their living room that we think they should, to open up those spaces of empathy. But like executives see those and they're like, oh, but that's untested. We've never sold that before. How do I know I can sell that now? And that's how they're approaching it, which is completely opposite of how we are.
I mean, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about IP. It's like suddenly at some point, actually, I think during the course of our careers, IP became the only way to get a project off the ground. It's ridiculous.
Oh, that's crazy.
But something else you said sparked something that really pisses me off in this industry. And let me talk about it for 1 second, which is like, development executives, stop coming to me with a germ of an idea and then acting like you're granting me a gift to go off and actually make the idea work. And then I have to come back to you and prove that I have come up with something worthy of going forward.
I know.
Get out of here with that shit. I'm not doing your work for you. Like, either come to me with an idea that somehow we can both take forward because there's enough there for me to really sink my teeth into, or just let me cook. Let me come up with my own idea, and I'll holler at you when I have a good idea. But this whole idea that screenwriters have to go off for free, by the way, and come up with your idea beat for beat, and then you're going to ask me questions after I tell you about my idea, like, well, what about the second act? I don't know about the second act yet. This is your stupid idea that I went off to try to make work. How am I supposed to know? I haven't read it yet. Oh my God. Just let Gina come up with her own ideas and buy those. They will be better.
They will be better. Yes.
In some article that you found through your lit agent.
Thank you.
And like in New York Times in 1992, published this article. Do you think it's a movie, Gina? Get out of here with that. She's got dope ideas. Buy those.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, this is a good article. Like, and this is an article. Like, this is what this is. This is an article. It should be an article. It should not be a movie or a television show. There's not enough story here. You're so right. Like, sometimes I feel like I'm in these meetings and I'm practically being asked, how many commas are you going to put in the script? Like, down to like, and it's just like, just let me write it. You will see.
Yes.
It will be good.
Yes.
Oh my God. Listen, it's like when you start asking me challenging questions about, they always do this sort of bait and switch, which is like, we'll just have a casual conversation. Just like if it sparks anything with you, you know, you don't have to come up with a full pitch. Just come back and tell me your thoughts. And then they're like, okay, in the second act, you said she was going to work out. So can you tell me what kind, how does she have her hair? Like, is it a barrette? Is it a scrunchie? How does she have her hair up if she's going to do, is it a yoga class or a spin class? And then like, I'm like, wait, now I'm on trial for my idea. This idea that I was just supposed to casually see if I responded to. Now I have to answer every specific question you have to win this job. It's a really backwards way about of coming up with ideas and movie scripts.
Yeah.
I hate it.
I agree.
Sorry, all right, ranting, guys.
That's it. No, we needed that. We needed that. Well, let's take it back to where it all began, and for this last topic, and take it back to film school.
Yes.
You say you've been hearing. You know, Sherman, you know, monitors the social media airwaves. He knows what all the kids are talking about. The questions they got, especially the Hollywood kids, like the kids that want to be in Hollywood or they're here now. He knows what's on their mind. He's got a finger on the pulse. And apparently one of the questions always is, film school yes or film school no? Is that true, Sherman?
Absolutely. From what I've seen, you know, on the message boards that I look at and Twitter and whatnot, I always see, you know, younger adults, whether they're just graduating high school or whether they're grad school age, trying to debate whether to make this sizable investment, because it is very expensive to go to a good film school. Should I try to go to film school, or should I just get to work writing, get to work, you know, working as an assistant or working as somebody on set? What route should I take? I have very specific thoughts about that, but I would love to hear what you guys have to say.
Let's start.
What advice would you give them?
Yeah, I get this question too a lot. And I think, honestly, it comes down to being very honest with yourself about how good you currently are. Like, I knew coming out of undergrad that I did not know how to write a good script. And I needed space, a safe space, to experiment, to figure out what I like, to be taught structure and how it works. And I knew that about myself. Obviously, the cost of going really sucks. Like, I'm not gonna lie, that is some serious debt.
Who here is not in six-figure debt from film school?
I have paid mine off.
Ooh.
So I have paid my loans off. I have.
I'm at 303.
Wait, what?
Yeah, she paid them off, bro.
Wait. Okay. First of all, the two crazy bombs were just dropped. Shoes at $303,000. And Gina has $0. I feel like you need to powwow with Gina offline and figure out what she is doing that you're not.
she's paying them. That's.
I don't have a house. I don't have a house. So
like. Yeah. Okay. Wow. I have not paid mine off. I'm making a small debt now. Just now, I'm starting to make a small debt.
I pay them every month for the record, but they just don't go anywhere.
Yeah, if you're just paying the minimum, that's how they get you, bro.
That is how they get you.
So your advice would really just be about your craft, because I see a lot of these conversations, they immediately go to stuff totally outside of craft and the artistic education that you'll get. They go straight to connections, how it can launch your career afterwards, sort of the more industry side of things. What do you say about that?
I mean, I'm not going to say that's not important, because it definitely is. And coming out of film school, I had no idea what to do, and I had to make those connections from scratch. But I will also say that the value that I get from knowing you guys and from knowing the people that we went to school with, whether you're actively getting me jobs or not, like, that is a life add that is priceless. Like, I can't imagine not knowing our classmates and people we went to school with. Yeah. Everybody is so talented. Everyone is inspiring. It's amazing to have a tribe in LA and people that get you. And I mean, I'm sorry, you can't put a price tag on that.
Yeah.
So it's more about, and I do find that younger people are already like, how can I get the connections to get that job and then get that money and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, slow down, dude, this script sucks. You know, and so, and it's like, you have to get good first. Like, you can't skip that step. I've read so many bad scripts, like so many. And it's just like, if you had just taken one class, this would like be so much better.
Yeah. People don't really acknowledge that you need talent and a dedication to craft. What they think is you just have to unlock the magic combination of industry connections and schmoozing. And then once you do that, you're on your way.
Yeah.
It's not that. You got to be dope on the page first. And it's doubly hard when you're just starting off, because people are skeptical of you because you haven't done anything yet. It actually gets a little bit easier the more jobs you get under your belt, because people just assume that you can do it.
Yeah.
I'll add that I think the tribe and the community that I found in grad school is priceless. I'll have a little anecdote about that real quick, which is, you know, in 2016, I was a struggling screenwriter. I, you know, was really in sort of a low point. This is a industry of feast and famine. I was definitely in a famine point, and I was really looking for that next gig. And one of our grad school friends sort of just introduced me to this person who gave me my next job. And I'll say that I didn't get that job through trying to find the industry connections. I didn't get that job through planning my strategy of how I was going to use this person as a stepping stone. I was just cool with this person. I was friendly with him. He was a friend first. We played fantasy football together back when that was a thing that we all did. You know, we had drinks together. We did not talk a lot about industry strategy and how we could help each other. It came from a genuine social connection, because we liked each other, and we're not best friends. We don't keep up, but we text every now and then, and we're cool with each other, and it's always all love when we see each other. And so I would like to tell young people who are looking at film school as this like industry stepping stone, as part of their mastermind strategy. Yeah, you can think that, but you also just have to be a person that people like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you just have to genuinely make real connections. If they're not genuine friends, at least let them be acquaintances who you like to be around and who you're cool with when you see them. That's going to get you way further in life than sort of the slimy planning mm-hmm. that you think Hollywood types do.
Yes, for mm-hmm. sure. I can't say it any better. That's 100% agreed.
I agree.
Well, it's been excellent having you, Gina. This has been so illuminating, I think.
Yes. Personally,
I learned a lot. I got to get different types of meetings. I learned that today. I'm going to work on that as soon as we get off.
I hope maybe you will, whatever happens with your projects, if one of them goes or blows up, that maybe you'll come back and join us and give us a little bit of an update.
Yeah.
That would be great.
I'd love to.
We're going to do our final segment, which you're welcome to take part in if you'd like. I'm going to turn it over to Sherman, who's going to introduce this part, but you'll soon find out what it is.
Yeah, this is a segment. It's very straightforward. It's called Don't Do That Shit.
It's
basically a chance for us to talk about the things that we see, trends that we see in the craft of screenwriting that we hate and that we want to see stop forever. And we just use it as a place to vent and hopefully give you a little bit of advice on how to improve your script. So, Shu, I'm going to throw it to you to go first today.
I'm trying to remember what mine was.
Oh, don't fumble now. I got one ready to go. I'll let it go.
You go first.
All right. The thing that I want to advise all of you guys, the shit that I want y'all to stop doing is, and this especially goes to young aspiring screenwriters, stop starting your script with like a day in the life. It is so boring. The alarm clock goes off. They slurp the alarm. They're in the shower. They're eating breakfast. They're driving to work or going to school. Cut it out. Who wants to see that? We all live that every day. It's not even interesting. It doesn't lend itself to an active protagonist. It's rote. It's boring. And you think, oh, it's going to be so interesting when they spill the cup of coffee or they run in late for the big meeting. It's not interesting, guys. We've seen it a million times. Stop it. Please, for the love of God, find an interesting way to start your script. Instead of having them wake up in bed and slap the alarm, have them wake up in a car that's speeding towards a cliff. That's a movie I want to see. Now you've got a winner. Stop it. Please, for the love of God, don't send me those scripts anymore. Thank you. Kindly.
That's a really good one. Don't do that shit.
I have to admit,
that one really hits me, man. Because it really hits me. Because I totally agree. And I currently have a pitch that I've been repeating to executives that starts with a motherfucker waking up.
No, don't do it. Okay, we're going to have to talk offline. I'm going to give you some notes.
And then going to brush his teeth. And then going to the office.
Don't do it. Shu, please. You're a better writer than this. Please. Please.
We'll see. It may. We'll see if it sells. Now I'm gonna have to change the beginning. That's a great one. I found mine is much more boring. But
boring counts too. You got to do the boring stuff right as well.
Here's the thing. I got a lot. Me, like everybody else who reads scripts, got a lot of shit to read. I don't have a lot of time, and I'm not an executive. So the one thing I don't want you, please don't do this shit. Do not write an action description that is like two paragraphs long. In fact, don't write it if it's more than like three lines. Four, maybe. It better be really punchy if it's four. Otherwise, break that shit up, make it less, cut a few sentences. I do not need to read paragraphs. I just want to get through the script. Do not do that shit.
Agree 100%. It's much better to just have one, just break it up artificially, just make it one line, you know, think about it in terms of shots. Tell us literally what we see and then continue with your long ass description, only it's broken up on the page so we can feel like we're moving through the script. 100% agree.
One thing that helps with that though was going to be mine, which is like, don't use like six words when two will do, you know, like
perfect.
I think part of the reason these paragraphs are so long is it's like, Joel walked very slowly down the street with no direction and no sense of where or when he was going. And it's just like, okay, Joel ambles down the street. Move on. Like, you know? That's right.
Four words will do it.
That's yes. right. That's perfect. Don't exactly. do that shit.
Perfect. Don't do it. Well, thanks again, Gina.
Thank you, Gina. Really thank appreciate you. It.
Yay.
Okay, guys. Well, thank you again for tuning in. We're going to wrap this episode up. Unless Shu has anything else to say, I will say, sayonara.
Sayonara.
This has been the Diversity Hires Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherman Payne.
And I'm Shukri Tillman. Thanks for listening. Our show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton. Shout out to AKB.
Please visit our website, thediversityhires.com, and follow us on social media of your choice. We are at DivHiresPod across all social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
You can find the Diversity Hires Podcast anywhere that you find podcasts.
Smash that subscribe button, homie.
Subscribe, please. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Peace.
Later.